So my job is to introduce our scholars and then our Native American artist and our two Ann Ray interns. First up, alphabetically, is C.J. Alvarez, who's the Mellon Latino Studies resident scholar. He's a member of the Department of Mexican American and Latino Studies at UT Austin. He has a PhD from the University of Chicago and a BA from Stanford. The title of his project is A History of the Chihuahuan Desert. CJ.
Hello, everyone. I'm here at SAR this year to write about the history of the Chihuahuan Desert. This is a very unusual topic for historians. Scientists know it really well. Scientists know it for its size. It's arguably the biggest desert on the continent in North America. It has a higher level of biodiversity than some forests, and this is something that scientists appreciate. But it's a very unpopular topic among historians. I think there are at least two reasons for this. The first reason is because counterintuitively, some very, very important political events have taken place inside the boundaries of the Chihuahuan Desert ecoregion. One of those, of course, is the demarcation and delineation of the U.S.-Mexico border in the 1840s and 1850s. That, of course, was and continues to be a controversial dividing line that attracts varying levels of political debate. Another hugely important political development within the Chihuahuan Desert was the successful detonation of the first atomic weapon down there at Trinity. Some of you might have been there and visited that site. And the third that I think is also important but often forgotten or overlooked on this side of the border is that some of the most significant battles of the Mexican Revolution, the first social revolution of the 20th century, were fought in the desert in the Mexican North. And that conflict produced some of the most important leaders, including a couple of presidents that are central to 20th century Mexican history, 21st century Mexican history as well. What these political developments have the effect of doing is refocusing the conversation away from the environment onto purely political developments. And what I've found is that people have a very difficult time thinking spatially and thinking geographically without using political borders. Here's these states and these territories, and here's this country, and here's that country. The second reason I think this has been an unpopular topic for historians, for environmental historians, is because of what I call exotic desert narratives. These come in two forms. The desert can only be one of two things. It can either be a wasteland, not valuable at all, something where no one lives, allegedly. Of course, it's never really the case. And that is economically valueless. Or it can be a beautiful, aesthetic, transcendental landscape for artistic inspiration, spiritual elevation, and so on and so forth. To my mind, both of these narratives are two sides of the same coin. They both exoticize the desert. And they're both perspectives that are typically held by outsiders. That is, the desert compared to something else. The desert is beautiful compared to something else. The desert is a wasteland compared to something else. And in these two regards, the Colorado Plateau and the Mojave Desert have been more attractive to writers who are interested in writing creative nonfiction about the desert, desert encounters, that sort of thing. So here's what I'm doing in contrast. Here's what I'll be up to over the course of the year. I'm focusing on the late 19th and 20th centuries, so this is a modern desert history. I'm not an archaeologist, so I'm focusing on a very modern period. I'm not a naturalist. I'm not writing about the environment for its own sake. I think political borders matter. What interests me most is the mutual constitution between political developments and ecological conditions, right? To bring the environment back in to these political stories and the background of those political stories that many of us know so well. I'm not interested in outsiders' views. I'm not interested in the wasteland narrative, and I'm not interested in the beautiful desert, beautiful landscape narrative. I'm interested in the perspectives of desert dwellers themselves, desert peoples themselves. To give you a sense of what I'm talking about, I'm working on an article slash chapter right now, and the provisional title is Desert People Don't Say Desert. And it's about the people living in the Tularosa Basin before the evacuation for the White Sands Missile Range. And I'm looking at how they talk about their confrontation with the environment, their interaction with the environment, and they almost never say desert, an outsider's word. So I look forward to talking to some of you later on, getting to know you all over the course of the year, and thanks very much.
Next up is Patricia Crown, who almost needs no introduction. She's the Distinguished Professor of Anthropology at UNM, a PhD from Arizona, BA from the University of Pennsylvania, winner of at least a half dozen major awards, most recently the Alfred Kidder Award for Eminence in the Field of Archaeology. We don't get too many eminences here, but we're glad to have Patty. We can kiss her ring when she gives her public talk. When I called her up to offer the prize, she said, Patty, by the way, has written I don't know how many books for us, and led seminar, really important seminars at SAR. She said, "Well, it took you 35 years. What was the delay?" But I said, "Better late than never," and we're absolutely delighted to have her here. The name of her project is "Drinking Practice and Politics in Chaco Canyon, New Mexico."
It is true. The first time I applied for an SAR residential fellowship was in 1984. So that gives you an idea of how hard they are to get. You guys are very lucky. Okay, so my project is on Chacoan cylinder jars that were produced between AD 875 and 1100. There are only 200 known cylinder jars in museums in the US, Chacoan cylinder jars, that is. They occur in about 10 museums. What I have done so far on this project, and those of you who know me and my work know that I've been working on this for about 2 decades, but I've gone and recorded all but 3 of the cylinder jars that are known in the museums, and that includes one here at SAR. I then did a project trying to figure out why some of them seem to have been repainted over time. They have multiple layers of slip and designs that you can see through the latest slip. Some of them were plastered and probably had colorful designs on them that you couldn't fire into them. And that was really a study of renewal of the vessels over time, so they seem to have had designs scrubbed off them and then new designs put on them over time. Then I wanted to know how the vessels were being used, and I got involved in an organic residue analysis study with a nutritional chemist at the Hershey Company in Pennsylvania. You may have heard of that. And we discovered that there were residues of cacao and residues probably of holly, Ilex vomitoria, which was used for black drink in the Southeast. And then I wanted to know more about how the vessels were discarded, because most of the 200 vessels occur in Pueblo Bonito, and most of those occur in one room in Pueblo Bonito, room 28. And so I applied to the Park Service to reopen the room, re-excavated it with UNM in 2013, and have just finished a book on the results of that excavation. But it told us a lot about how the vessels were ultimately terminated and destroyed in about 1100. So all of those projects together combine into the need for a book. Colleagues keep telling me that they'd like to see a book on the cylinder jars. So beyond the context, the use, the production, the exchange that's involved, I will be looking at drinking activity. Social drinking is important in every culture in the world. And I will be trying to understand more about social drinking practices in Chaco Canyon and how the cylinder jars were used for that. And I'm going to stop here because I will be talking about this again in 2 weeks, and I hope to see some of you here then. Thank you.
I'm pleased to introduce Rashmi Sadana. Patty, by the way, is a Weatherhead fellow, as is Rashmi Sadana, associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at George Mason University. She has a PhD from UC Berkeley and a BA from Berkeley. She's an IBIT. That's what they call them at Harvard anyway. The title of her project is Gender, Urban Space, and Everyday Life in the Age of the Delhi Metro, 2002 to 2018.
Hi, it's great to be here and great to see all of you. My research focus is urban India, and I've been most interested in how Indians live and express their modernity, what it means to craft a modern self that encapsulates one's past, present, and hopes for the future. My project I'm working on here this year at SAR is about the social impact of Delhi's new metro rail system. As a mega city of 20 million, Delhi has its metro was built on top of and under an already highly developed, socially complex, and densely populated landscape. So my study is a street-level ethnography of this interface between the metro system and the city. The system started running in 2002 and is the first multi-line metro rail system in all of South Asia. It's really massive. It's already 8 lines, over 250 stations, and it covers over 200 miles of the Delhi National Capital Region, making it the 8th longest metro system in the world. So the metro is firstly a mega infrastructure project. It's backed by Japanese loans, has many transnational partners who were involved in the designing and implementation of the system. Now most of the production has been indigenized, and now Indians are advising other countries all over the world on their metro systems. So most studies of metro and subway systems chronicle the construction, which is always, as we know, an amazing feat of engineering. But my focus is really on the larger social implications of the metro. And my aim is to understand what it means for the society, its people, and the plan for the urban future. So what first got me into the project was a simple metro ride that I took in 2004, so quite some time ago. And getting on this kind of transport in this ancient and modern city was nothing short of epic, largely because of the contrast with what was outside the metro, the urban street, but also because of the sense of time-space compression. You could feel the city contracting as you rode the metro in those early years. Delhi is a city filled with ancient monuments, Mughal-era architecture, and colonial and post-colonial urban planning. The metro ties these logics together by overlaying a material, concrete infrastructure, but also enabling a new imaginary of the city. So basically, I was inspired by this first metro ride, and soon four research areas began to develop in my mind. So the first was everyday mobility, people's mobility. A one-hour journey from point A to B now took 20 minutes. There were new forms of sociality on the trains, new ways of interacting between men and women, and also between different social classes in this high-tech, highly surveyed, air-conditioned, hyper-modern space that was cut off from the outside and yet was mapping it anew. Another one of my research areas became understanding the urban landscape and how it was changing. The Delhi Metro is about 75% of it is actually above ground. So it makes a big physical and visual impact on numerous neighborhoods all across the city. The system not only provides transport, but is also a vast new set of public places, places to hang out and be and forge new social, economic, and other ties. It is also a concrete object giving new borders to the city and its peripheral regions. And in the process, it breaks down notions of urban and rural, which has been very central to the study of India. Finally, the metro is a corporation, a new style of governance, and an example of the kind of technocratic thinking at work in India today. So these are my research areas, and I'm really motivated by a couple of questions. One is, what are the contradictions of this kind of capital-intensive project, which privileges higher-end property development and a globalized middle-class lifestyle in a city where the majority of people are low income and mostly ride the bus. The second question was, to what extent is the metro a social leveler as people from different backgrounds and positions rub shoulders in this new high-tech environment? What are the on-the-ground social and material impacts of the metro system on people's lives, aspirations, and senses of self? So I've been studying the metro for the last 10 years, talking to people, observing all of the lines and stations, interviewing officials, planners, architects, and now the system is arguably not new anymore. I notice now that when I interview younger people, they don't have a memory of the city before the metro. And so that is an indication to me that it's time to finish my book manuscript. And so while at SAR, I will be drawing on my wealth of data to write an ethnographic account of social mobility and urbanization in 21st century India. Thank you.
Some of you may know that this is the fourth year of the Mellon Foundation-funded program in Latino Studies at SAR. That was a welcome addition to our scholarly program. It's been very successful. CJ is one of our two this year. The second is Fatima Suarez, who comes to us from UC Santa Barbara, where she's a doctoral candidate. She has a master's degree from the London School of Economics and a BA from University of Laverne. The title of her project is The Meanings of Latino Fatherhoods.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. Good afternoon, everyone. On June 2015, Latino Voices, which is a series published by the Huffington Post, published an article entitled, "This is What Being a Latino Father Means Today." Many of the featured Latinx subscribers characterize their fathers as hardworking, loving, committed, strong, and above all, willing to do anything for their kids. It is ironic, though, that this post was published just 4 days after Donald Trump attacked Mexicans, specifically Mexican immigrant men, by calling them criminals, rapists, and drug dealers, in other words, bad hombres, in the speech where he announced his candidacy for the U.S. presidency. Now, public responses to these disparaging comments were diverse, and what I saw were two types of responses. One, at the institutional and organizational level, for instance, civil rights organizations like Unidos US focus its efforts on mobilizing the Latino voting bloc that some call the sleeping giant, while other organizations like media corporations such as Univision severed its ties with the Trump organization. However, collectively on the ground, what I saw was that people were mobilizing discourses of responsible fatherhood in order to humanize Latino immigrant men. People were justifying men's migration to the United States because they, argued, are fulfilling the most basic expectation that we have of fathers, and that is to provide. In other words, these men are not migrating to the United States to steal American jobs, commit crimes, or deplete the U.S. of its resources. These men are risking their lives, coming to the United States, working in deplorable working conditions for their kids, in order to provide food on the table, in order to give their family a better life. And the resources and the means to do so do not exist in their home countries. And I share this story with you as part of my introduction because this is one observation, one major event that gave birth to my intellectual project. And the pun was absolutely intended. My dissertation is a qualitative study that seeks to answer the question, what does fatherhood mean in the lives of Latino men? My research is based on 60 in-depth interviews with self-identified Latino fathers in the state of California who are diverse in terms of their age, class status, and generation in the United States, which I believe are the three elements that will have the greatest impact on the meanings that they attach to fatherhood. Another issue that I engage is how Latino men enact the meanings that they attach to fatherhood. This question gets at the ways in which Latino fathers as social agents, navigate the cultural and the structural landscapes that both create and constrain opportunities for them to exercise their idealized vision of fatherhood. Another issue I engage is how do Latino men enact the emotional labor of fathering, and how men's emotional labor is distinct from how we traditionally think about women's emotional labor in the family. Lastly, my dissertation also examines how men monitor other men's fatherhood. And from my interviews, I've learned that women play a pivotal role in not just monitoring, but also defining fatherhood for these men. So although my dissertation is a story about men's intimate lives, it is also a tale about women. During my tenure here at the School for Advanced Research, I will be writing my dissertation, or as how we graduate students like to call, dissertating. For my colloquium presentation in November, I will be discussing my experiences interviewing Latino fathers and propose that my participants approach the interview setting as part of their responsibilities of fatherhood, as fathers, excuse me. And they also approach the interview setting as an opportunity to perform an idealized version of the good father, which they may or may not necessarily meet. And I just realized that I probably gave you the gist of my talk right now. But they say that the thrill is in the details. So I hope to see you in November for the details. Thank you.
This year's Anne Ray Fellow is Davina Two Bears. We had a near miss with Davina 3 years ago when she passed this over for a fellowship at Dartmouth, and we're glad to close the circle. And some of you may remember that her daughter Brenna was an Anne Ray intern 2 years ago, so we're kind of, SAR is a sort of family affair for the Two Bears family. Davina just completed her PhD at Indiana University. She has a BA from Dartmouth. The name of her project, and I won't attempt the Navajo part of the title, is My Grandparents' School, Navajo Survivance and Education at the Old Lep School,
1909 to 1942. Hi, I'm Davina Two Bears. I'm originally from a community called Burt Springs in northern Arizona on the southwestern part of the Navajo Reservation. And I'd like to thank all of you for coming here today, and thank you to the SAR. My project, Shemasane Do Shiche Beoltra, is the Navajo title. It's my grandfather and grandmother's school. This project is a personal project of mine. It stems from stories that my grandparents told me when I was a child about going to boarding school on the Navajo Reservation at Loop. And I was also entertained by their stories as a child. And when I got older and I became a tribal archaeologist for the Navajo Nation, I worked on the western half of the Navajo Reservation doing cultural resource inventories, and I realized a couple of things. One was that Navajo historic sites often get overlooked, or they're not given much attention by southwestern archaeologists, even from my own tribe, and the focus is on ancient sites. Ancestral Puebloan sites, and they are often thoroughly documented. And I also realized that this huge historic site in my community, the Old Loop Boarding School site, had never been documented in the literature or written about. It's mentioned, the name of the school, and also it had not been recorded as an archaeological site. So I decided to go back to school to obtain my degree. And I felt that this was probably one of the best ways that I would be able to research Navajo sites. That was my goal, is to get a PhD so that I could go back to my community and research places of importance to the Navajo people. And the Old Loop Boarding School site is well known in the communities of Loop and Burt Springs, which are between Flagstaff and Winslow, Arizona. But there's oral history about this place, but nothing is written. And I really wanted to fill this gap for my community, or to fill the gap about early Navajo education on the reservation. So I wanted to document the history of the boarding school. And although I'm interested in archaeology, I'm also uncomfortable with the methods of archaeology. So I want to research archaeological sites with non-destructive research methods. So I conducted interviews with elders who went to school at the Olute boarding school. And I also did archival research in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., Denver, Colorado, and Riverside, California for my dissertation. It's a really fascinating tale, but my interest also is in focusing on those stories of survivance within boarding schools, not the negative narratives that we often hear, although those are important to hear as well. But I also wanted to focus on stories of survivance and how Navajo children connected with their culture and identity, even though they were being forced to assimilate into Western society. But it was really hard for me to find elders who went to school there because they're all in their late 80s and early 90s. And some of them, I wanted to interview them and I would contact them. And then a couple months later, they had already passed away. But anyway, this project is really a personal project of mine. It's decolonizing research because I'm researching mostly for the benefit of my community and my tribe. This is what has motivated me all these years to do this research on the Olute boarding school, which was in operation from 1909 to 1942. And even though it was open for like 30 years, there's no history written about this school. And hundreds of Navajo students attended school here in the early 20th century, including my grandparents. So I hope all of you will come and attend my talk in November and we can learn more about this school. And I'm really excited to be back in the Southwest after living in New Hampshire and Vermont for the past 2 years and Indiana for the past 7 years since 2010, which was kind of scary, but Bloomington is a great place. So thank you.
Before I introduce our Native artist and interns, I want to mention our Lamont fellow who couldn't be present today. Under a special arrangement, the Haida couture designer, Dorothy Grant, will be here in the spring. Dorothy is arguably one of the, maybe the most distinguished Native American fashionista, a very successful line of women's clothing. She's been given the Order of Canada, which I understand to be the highest civilian honor available to Canadians. And she'll be here working in the spring on her autobiography. This year's Rollin and Mary Ella King Fellow is Timothy Azuni Potter, and he'll tell you about his project.
I come from the Pueblo of Zuni. I've been a resident there all my life. I've gotten interested with pottery a while back, and I got my formal education on the pottery making back in high school. And the person that taught me was Gabriel Paloma. He was the one that actually got me into the basics of pottery making. And from there, I did not really get too much into it until years later when I met my former partner. And from there, I got more interested into the pottery making of Zuni, especially around the time period of 1680 when the evolution of Zuni pottery started evolving. The focus on this one piece that I am here for is called the Ashwi pot, and that's the pot labeled number one here at SCR. And there's this story about this one particular pot that really interested me because of the oral traditions of what our people went through during the Pueblo Revolt. During this time, about 20 plus years, the communities of Zuni Pueblo, there was Hawiku, Matsakia, Kyakima, Kechibawa, Halawana, they all fled up to the Stronghold Mesa and stayed up there for about 23 plus years. And when they were up there, they kept going back and forth down into the valley to try and reestablish these home sites. But when they did, I guess it was still too violent during those times, warfare with our neighbors, with the Navajo tribes and Apaches and the Spanish. So they kept going up to the Mesa until they finally decided that it was time to come down. And instead of going to their original home sites, they founded Zuni Pueblo, Halona Itiwana. When they did that, this was the founding of everything that is Zuni today. And this is why I hold the Ashui piece that's here at SAR, a symbolic representation of this merging of all the Pueblo communities from the Zuni Valley area. And this is what I'm focusing on by researching the shapes and transitions of the Zuni pottery that is known today. It started from the Matsuake type of pottery, which is prehistoric, pre-Hispanic, leading to Ashui polychrome, then Kayapkwa, then modern Zuni pottery. From there, I've been looking at a lot of the collections here, and I've seen a lot of the transitional phases of the pottery, and that's what's been really interesting me, especially with the designs, especially, because a lot of it have symbolic representations of rain, prayers, and symbolic meanings of the potter's intentions on what they want on the pots. As we were discussing, Patty and I, we were discussing about the symbology, especially what they were focusing on was prayers for rain, mostly, on these pots, these vessels. And that's what we were discussing and debating and fun arguing about some of the designs, what they could mean. And it pretty much really got me to look much more deeper into what the symbology of these designs mean, especially for the Zuni time period of Ashui polychrome. And that's my project for here, because I want to relearn some of these designs that are pretty much dominant during this period, because it shows an involvement from Matsuake to the transition of Ashui, when the basic shape of the pot was more globular, and that was a dominant type of shape which was known in this area, the Rio Grande area. From that time period, that trading, and I'm pretty sure a lot of the people fleeing from this area, the Rio Grande, fled west, and I know a lot of them have stories of migrating for sanctuary, fleeing from the Spanish. And when they did, I know they brought ideas of different pottery shapes and pottery designs, especially the paint. They switched from a glaze paint to a matte paint finish. From there on, it evolved again, and they left the glazeware paint and they switched more to a matte paint finish. When they started doing that, the designs also changed, and that's when it started radically changing from the prehistoric Sikyaki style designs to more of the early beginnings of what Zuni designs were becoming, the transition. And for my project here, I'm going to replicate the Ashui pot. Because of the shape, it's really hard to actually put together, because the first time I made a piece like that, I had a hard time trying to make it because it collapsed on me because of the weight and what I call the spare tire or a mid-bulge around the pot. That was kind of too heavy, but trial and error, I figured it out, and then I made the shape. And then I focused on more of the designs, because the designs, they're more feathery, which I've noticed with some of the collections that I have seen here, that the designs from that time period were mostly feathers. And a lot of feather imagery from that time, it kept repeating over and over. So I was concluding that these were prayers for rain, and just symbolic prayers for probably a lot of things, what the potter had intentions about when they were building the pot. After my research, I will recreate a historic Zuni stew bowl from one of the collections here, and the Ashui pot using the traditional methods with the clay, the paints, the pigments, and the shards, all that comes from Zuni land. And a lot of it, especially the shards, it's a funny story. One of the archaeologists at Flagstaff, Arizona, he brought a big box which accumulated about a year's worth of police stops. And when they were doing these police blocks, you know, they would look through the vehicles and they would find pottery shards that they would pick up at the sites. So I'm pretty sure these sites that they were picking these shards from were from Wapaki. A lot of these shards, they didn't, you know, they didn't know where they came from, so he labeled them as dead shards. And it was just growing to a year's worth, and then he had like about two huge boxes of shards that accumulated with over a year's worth. When he approached me at the Zuni art show in Flagstaff, he asked me if I use shards for temper in my clay, and I said yes. So when he brought it over, I was expecting like a small bag, and here he brought this huge box over, and then I didn't really expect that much. So a lot of the shards that I use is from the Flagstaff area. So there is real prehistoric shards that I actually use and crush for grog in my clay. And with the paints and the pigments, all that I search on Zuni land. Everything comes from Zuni land. As for the paint and the hematite ore, that is also local from Zuni. After my study and research, what I will learn from here, from the archives and collections at SCR, I hope to verify and better understand the transition from Ashiwi polychrome to present-day modern Zuni pottery. I plan to reintroduce this type of elaborate designs used by my ancestors to present-day Zuni potters who are unaware of the older transitional shapes and forms. I would like to verify the use and shapes and designs of the prehistoric and historic pots for the use in my art and for the knowledge to be passed to the public in Pueblo. In hopes this will add credibility and recognition for my art, a dying tradition in my Pueblo. Thank you. Elako.
As in past years, we have two ANRE interns. This is a program funded by the ANRE Foundation, which is part of the Margaret A. Cargill Philanthropies, one of our most important philanthropic partners. This program, which is run and administered by the Indian Arts Research Center, has been notably successful in helping young museum professionals, many of them native, to advance their professional careers, and the track record is quite remarkable. And the first of our two ANRE interns this year is Amanda Sorensen, who had just completed her studies in museum studies at the University of British Columbia. Amanda.
Hello. During our internship time, we have time set aside specifically for our research. So my research project will continue on work that I already started as an anthropology graduate fellow at the National Museum of Natural History, which I call NMNH. And I plan to write an article about the work I did this summer. Specifically, I will be examining how culturally appropriative collections are cataloged within the Smithsonian data keeping systems, and what this tells us about the Smithsonian's perceptions of these collections when a given record was written. This particular case study, it illustrates the extent to which museum catalog information continues to impact future understandings of a given piece. My research project started with a pair of leggings, and within the public NMNH database, they're called the blanket leggings, and the catalog card describes them as follows. Made by Reverend E. W. J. Linsmith in 1908 from a black striped gray blanket formerly belonging to Two Moons of Rosebud River, Montana, as an exact copy of the Indians' everyday leggings. Linsmith was an army chaplain stationed at Fort Keogh, Montana from 1880 to 1891, and he acquired the majority of his collection by building relationships with Cheyenne and Crow Army scouts. These leggings were accessioned. They were accepted into the NMH anthropology collections in July of 1956. Initially, I questioned where this catalog information had come from, because it's not clear. Linsmith, he had attached handwritten tags to many of his collections pieces. And we know this because there are pieces at the Snipe Museum of Art that still have them. He wrote on these tags a lot of information about what a given piece is and where, when, and from whom he acquired it, He also kept a personal but partial catalog where he kept copies of this information. And this is located within his papers at the Catholic University of America. And comparing his catalog to the information that NMNH has, I found significant overlap between Linsman's accounts in his catalog and what NMNH staff had written about a given piece. So I believe that when the Linsmith collection moved from the Catholic University of America to NMNH in 1956, the cataloger working on transferring the tag information in the catalog translated Linsmith sentences into their own words, and somewhere along the way, the individual tags were discarded. So ultimately, we can trust that Linsmith at least claimed to make these leggings, if not construct them himself. And he claimed to make other things within his collections, so this is not out of character. The blanket leggings, then, are an act of cultural appropriation, because in the words of Anishinaabe legal scholar Leonor Kishik Tobias, they're an act, quote, taking from a culture that is not one's own, intellectual property, cultural expressions and artifacts, histories and ways of knowledge, end quote. Furthermore, they are tools of settler colonialism, and as such, their associated catalog card descriptions serve to collapse indigenous everyday leggings designs into one copy. So then why, under the culture description in the NMNH database, are they cataloged as Cheyenne? And what does this tell us about museum perceptions of this garment in the 1950s? So I plan to consider these questions within this case study and consider a few other case studies with NMNH collections in the subsequent article. Thank you.
Our second ANRAE intern is Erin Monique Grant. She's a Hopi member of the Colorado River Indian Tribes, Parker, Arizona, and a recent graduate of the New School in New York, receiving an MA in History of Design and Curatorial Studies. Erin.
Hello, everyone. Looks like it's best for last. All right, well, thank you, Michael, for the intro. Of course, my name is Erin Monique Grant, and I'm one of two ANRAE interns this year. I was born and raised in Tempe, Arizona, and my family's from the Colorado River Indians tribes of Parker, Arizona. So as an ANRAE intern, we spend a portion of our time researching our self-determined projects. I'm already amazed by Amanda's. But for my project, I accepted an offer to draft new website content for the New York-based Vilcek Foundation, specifically for their Pueblo pottery collection. And so in their collection, there are 46 pieces of Pueblo pottery, ranging from Acoma, Zia, Zuni, Hopi, and a few others. And my goal with each of these objects is to write concise and descriptive sentences, really just to add context to these pieces. So, of course, thinking about the maker, its significance, symbolism, and additional background information. I will also be revising their About the Collections page. Overall, my work is going to help aid the Vilcek Foundation's goal for a complete redesign of their website and to also hopefully garner further engagement. So definitely go check out the website. And I'm just, you know, completely excited to help with it. I'm also excited really just to further my understanding with Pueblo pottery with this research and to utilize the vast amount of resources here at SAR and the IARC. For instance, one of my first steps was to reach out to Tim, the King Native Artist Fellow, and to really hear his thoughts about all of the pottery, as he's a Zuni artist that strives to strengthen and preserve his own culture. Some of my next steps are, of course, to speak further with those at the Vilcek, and really to look into all of the sources I've been recommended and even other people that stepped through the door of the IARC. Lastly, thank you all for your time. Thank you to SAR and the IRAC for this opportunity. And Amanda and I hope to see you back in May for our colloquium. Thank you again.
So that's our lineup for this year. I think you can tell it's a talented group, as talented as any group I've seen in the years that I've been here. I look forward to seeing you at their talks, or in Tim's case, at his artist talk and gallery tour in the coming weeks. That's it for today. Thanks for coming.